This is Rewind. Rewind.
On October 20th, 1967, two cowboys rode their horses into a remote creek bed in Northern California. They were looking for Bigfoot, and according to them, they found it. What they brought back was 59 seconds of grainy, shaky 16mm film showing a large, dark-haired, ape-like figure walking upright along the edge of the creek. Depending on who you ask, this footage has been called the most important piece of evidence for Bigfoot's existence, or one of the most elaborate hoaxes ever pulled off. But here's what makes it so unsettling. Despite nearly 60 years of analysis by scientists, Hollywood special effects artists, forensic examiners, and biomechanics experts, no one has definitively proven it's fake, although no one has proven it's real either. Today, I'll break down the full story of the Patterson-Gimlin film, who made it, how they made it, and what's actually on it. But to understand the film, we first have to understand the legend behind it. Because the story of Bigfoot didn't start in 1967. It didn't even start in the last century. It goes back thousands of years. By the end, you'll have to decide for yourself, is Bigfoot real? Is the film a masterpiece of deception? Or...
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. TNCs apply.
What is that?
Oh, yeah, it's a World Cup holder.
Like the soccer tournament World Cup?
Holder. For the world. Fits every car, holds every cup.
It has a Carvana logo?
Yeah, Carvana made it. They buy and sell cars, so they made a car cup holder. So, got any good cups lately?
Yeah, used to. Just couldn't figure out where in the world to put them.
The World Cup holder. Brought to you by Carvana. Proud sponsors of the World Cup holder.
Sign up today to win yours at cup-holder2026.com. Not authorized or endorsed by FIFA. Not a real product. For parody and fair use purposes only.
Is the truth somehow weirder than both? I'm Dr. Harini Bhatt, and this is Hidden History, a Rewind original powered by Pave Studios. On the show, we're exploring some of the most mysterious events from history that have yet to be fully explained, and examining all the different theories from science to the supernatural and everything in between. From vanished civilizations and doomsday prophecies to paranormal experiences and unexplained phenomena, I'm looking at it all, and I want you to join me. Before we begin, I'd love it if you could rate, review, and follow Hidden History. Your support allows our community to grow and for other people to discover the show. Today's episode is about the most famous piece of Bigfoot evidence ever captured, the Patterson-Gimlin film. Shot in 1967 by two rodeo cowboys in the forests of Northern California, this 59-second clip has been analyzed, debated, and fought over for nearly six decades. So what's really on that film? Let's talk about it. Before we get to the film, we need to talk about what came before it, because the Patterson-Gimlin film didn't emerge from nowhere. It came out of a tradition that stretches back thousands of years. Long before the word Bigfoot entered the American vocabulary, indigenous peoples across the United States and Canada had their own names and stories for large, hair-covered, human-like beings that lived in the forests. And these weren't fringe legends, they were central to many tribal cultures. The modern word Sasquatch itself comes from an anglicization of Saskatoon, a word from the language spoken by First Nation peoples in what's now British Columbia. For them, Saskatoon wasn't a monster to be hunted, it was a powerful forest being, part of the land to be treated with respect. And they were far from alone. Dozens of tribal nations across the continent had similar traditions. The Lummi people of the Pacific Northwest spoke of nocturnal, hairy giants dwelling in the mountains. The Lakota Sioux told of a great elder brother who watched over the land. the Hoopa Valley tribe in Northern California, whose territory is in the region where the Patterson-Gimlin film was shot, had stories of a wise forest being said to possess ancient knowledge of natural medicines. And you don't have to just take their word for it. On the Tule River Indian Reservation in California, petroglyphs estimated to be about 1,000 years old depict figures called Maya Datut. According to the people who created them, these were large, shaggy creatures that were generally benevolent but could be dangerous if disrespected. So when European settlers started reporting encounters with wild men in the 1800s and early 1900s, they weren't discovering something new. They were stumbling into a story that was already ancient. The term Sasquatch entered English in 1929 when a teacher named J.W. Burns published a collection of First Nations stories from British Columbia in Maclean's magazine. But the name that would stick, Bigfoot, wouldn't arrive for almost 30 more years. Let's fast forward to the summer of 1958. On the morning of August 27th, a bulldozer operator named Jerry Crew was clearing a logging road near Bluff Creek in Northern California's Six Rivers National Forest. When he climbed down for a break, he noticed something strange in the dirt around his machine. Footprints, enormous ones, almost 16 inches long and 7 inches wide, pressed deeply into the graded road, far too large and heavy to be a bear or a man. Crew told his foreman, and it turned out other workers had been finding similar prints at other sites in the area. Heavy equipment had been moved overnight. A 450-pound drum of diesel had vanished and turned up at the bottom of a gully, as if something had picked it up and thrown it. The workers started calling whoever was responsible Bigfoot. Crew made plaster casts of the prints and brought them to the local newspaper. On October 6, 1958, Humboldt Times columnist Andrew Gonzoli ran the story under the headline, Giant Footprints Puzzle Residents Along Trinity River. The story hit the wire services. It ran in the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times. And just like that, the name Bigfoot entered the American lexicon. But before we get ahead of ourselves, here's our first hoax alert. The logging operation was run by a guy named Ray Wallace. When Wallace died in 2002, his family came forward with wooden feet they said that he'd used to fake the prints as a prank. His son told reporters, quote, Ray L. Wallace was Bigfoot. The reality is Bigfoot just died, end quote. Case closed, right? Not exactly. When researchers compared Wallace's crude wooden feet to the actual plaster casts Jerry Crew had made, they didn't match. And this wasn't just speculation from amateur cryptid lovers. Jeff Meldrum was a professor of anatomy and anthropology at Idaho State University who spent his career studying foot morphology and primate locomotion, basically the go-to guy for understanding how primates move. And he was positive that Wallace's carved feet couldn't have produced the prints that Jerry Crew had documented. There's no question Wallace was a prolific prankster. But whether he was responsible for all the Bluff Creek evidence or whether something else was also leaving tracks in those woods remains genuinely unclear. What is clear is that by the mid-1960s, Bigfoot fever was spreading. People were finding tracks, reporting sightings, and heading into the wilderness to look for the creature. And among them was a man who would go on to create the most famous and most controversial piece of Bigfoot evidence in history. His name was Roger Patterson, a 34-year-old former rodeo cowboy from Yakima, Washington. He was charismatic, driven, restless, and broke. Patterson was known to bounce checks, dodge creditors, and make promises he couldn't keep. He had a family to feed with no steady income. He had also been diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, adding a layer of urgency to everything he did. This was a man who knew his time might be running out, and he saw Bigfoot as his way to financial security. In 1966, he published a self-financed book called Do Abominable Snowmen of America Really Exist, compiling sightings from across North America. But that wasn't enough for him. he'd also started filming a pseudo-documentary about cowboys hunting Bigfoot. None of that means he faked what came next, but it matters for context. Because in October of 1967, Roger Patterson set out for the forests of Northern California, and he would come back with footage that would change everything. To understand how the most famous Bigfoot film ever made came to be, we actually need to start about 25 miles west of Bluff Creek, where Jerry Crew first saw those footprints on a logging road called Blue Creek Mountain Road. In late August of 1967, just a few weeks before Patterson left on his trip, a worker named Bud Ryerson made an urgent call to Canadian journalist John Green. He'd found multiple large footprints along the road just a few miles from earlier track discoveries in the area. Green flew down immediately from British Columbia, joined by Bigfoot researcher Renee DeHinden. What they found was remarkable. At least three different sets of tracks, measuring roughly 15 inches, 13 inches, and 10.5 inches, had been left along the road and into the surrounding creek bed. DeHinden filmed the tracks while Green took photographs. They also brought in Dr. Donald Abbott, an archaeologist from the British Columbia Provincial Museum. This was big because he was one of the few credentialed scientists to take Bigfoot seriously at that time. And get this, Abbott examined the tracks in person but couldn't explain what had made them. News of the Blue Creek Mountain discovery reached Roger Patterson through Al Hodgson, the owner of a variety store in the nearby town of Willow Creek. Hodgson had become the unofficial hub for Bigfoot reports in the area. For years, anyone who found tracks or had a sighting in the Bluff Creek region eventually ended up at his door. Hodgson knew Patterson was interested in Bigfoot, so he passed on the news about the Blue Creek Mountain tracks. And when Patterson heard about them, he didn't hesitate. He and his friend, Bob Gimlin, started planning their expedition immediately. Gimlin was Patterson's opposite in a lot of ways. Steady, quiet, skeptical. But they had a lot in common, too. They were both from Yakima and were tough, physical guys who'd grown up around horses, rodeos, and the outdoors. All to say, they were comfortable in the wilderness. But Gimlin wasn't a true believer in Bigfoot. He later said he went along mostly because Patterson was his friend. The trip sounded like an adventure, and he didn't want Patterson going alone into the backcountry. But he brought his rifle just in case. Meanwhile, Patterson brought along a rented 16mm Kodak movie camera. He kept it in a saddlebag at all times, loaded and ready. In October 1967, the two men loaded up Gimlin's truck with three horses and several days' worth of provisions and drove to the Six Rivers National Forest in Northern California, heading for the Bluff Creek area. On October 20th, a clear, sunny autumn day, Patterson and Gimlin were riding along the creek bed when they rounded a bend and their horses suddenly spooked. About 80 to 100 feet ahead, on the opposite side of the creek, was a large figure. It was upright, it was covered in dark hair, and it was walking. Patterson's horses reared up. He fell from the saddle, scrambled to grab his camera from the saddlebag, and took off running toward the creature, filming as he went. The footage is shaky at first. You can feel the chaos of the moment, but then it stabilizes as Patterson finds his footing. What the camera captured over the next 59 seconds has become one of the most scrutinized pieces of film in history. The figure, later nicknamed Patty by researchers after Roger Patterson himself, walks steadily from left to right across the frame. Its arms swing in long, fluid arcs. Its knees are bent in what biomechanics experts call a compliant gait, which is a way of walking that's distinctly different from how humans typically move. The creature appears to be female with visible breasts. And then comes the moment. Around frame 352, the creature turns its head and upper body and looks directly back at Patterson and Gimlin. That single frame, the dark face, the heavy brow ridge, the calm, almost dismissive glance over the shoulder, became the defining image of Bigfoot in popular culture. After turning, the creature continues walking and disappears into the tree line. Bob Gimlin, who stayed on his horse with his rifle ready, later recalled the moment vividly. In a 2017 interview, he said, quote, "The moment I saw her, I just said, oh my God, they really do exist," end quote. The men didn't pursue the creature into the forest. Instead, they examined the area and found a clear trail of footprints. The prints were 14.5 inches long with a stride of about 41 inches. Patterson made plaster casts of several of them. That evening, he drove about 54 miles south to Willow Creek and went straight to Al Hodgson's store. Patterson told Hodgson what had happened and asked him to call Dr. Donald Abbott, the same scientist who'd examined the Blue Creek mountain tracks just weeks before. Patterson had a specific request. He wanted Abbott to come down with a tracking dog and help them find the creature while the trail was still fresh. As Bigfoot believer and physical anthropologist Grover Krantz of Washington State University later pointed out, this same-day call to a scientist was evidence against a hoax. If you had just faked a Bigfoot film, the last thing you'd want is a respected researcher showing up with tracking dogs to investigate the site. But Abbott said no, which meant nobody else could verify the discovery. But Patterson wasn't going to let that stop him. He drove on to the city of Eureka to ship the film to his brother-in-law for development. When the footage came back, it was unlike anything the Bigfoot world had ever seen. For the first time, there was a moving color film of a creature that matched the descriptions people had been reporting for decades. Patterson and Gimlin took the film on a barnstorming tour, screening it in auditoriums and theaters across the Pacific Northwest. In the pre-internet age, curious locals snapped up tickets to see it for themselves. The Patterson-Gimlin film, or PGF as researchers call it, is often described as one of the most watched short film reels in history and is frequently compared to the Zapruder film of the Kennedy assassination. Much like the Zapruder film divided a nation over what really happened in Dallas, the PGF split the world into two camps: those who saw undeniable proof of an unknown creature and those who saw nothing more than a man in a costume. And just like the Zapruder film, that debate still rages on today. As soon as the weather starts heating up, I immediately start pulling my lighter fabrics to the front of my closet. The pieces that look effortless but actually feel good the moment you pull them on, which for me is usually something linen. That is exactly why I keep coming back to Quince. They specialize in high-quality essentials like breathable linen, soft organic cotton, and even washable silk. But they do it all without that typical luxury markup. They have beautiful everyday pieces like 100% European linen pants, dresses, and tops with styles starting at just $32. Their denim is surprisingly soft, and I've been living in their linen button-down and paired with some gold jewelry. It's so lightweight, I actually forget I'm wearing it. And it isn't just clothes. They've become a total destination for home, kitchen, and bedding too. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/hidden for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/hidden for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/hidden.
Yo, it's Jay Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored.
When I'm looking for high-quality furniture that doesn't break the bank, I don't have to settle for subpar styles because I can find everything I need at Bob's Discount Furniture. At Bob's, I can score everyday low prices on pieces that real customers love, like Consumer Reports recommended mattresses, real marble dining sets, and the best-selling modular Bob's sectional, which has over 1,700 five-star reviews. So stock up on five-star style and visit Bob's, where America shops for furniture.
From the moment of the PGF footage was shown publicly, the debate was fierce and has never let up. Let's start with the believers. Physical anthropologist Grover Krantz, the professor who vouched for the scientific credibility a Patterson same-day call to Dr. Abbott, became one of the film's most vocal defenders. Kranz spent years analyzing the footage and the associated footprint casts. He argued that the creature's proportions, particularly the length of its arms relative to its body and the way its muscles appeared to move under the skin, were inconsistent with a human in a costume. There's also Jeff Muldrum, the Idaho State University professor of anatomy and anthropology who challenged the Ray Wallace wooden feet hoax. Before his death in 2025, Meldrum had assembled one of the world's largest collections of alleged Sasquatch footprint casts and remained one of the few credentialed academics willing to take the evidence seriously. He argued that the creature's foot structure, its bent knee gait, and its overall body proportions don't match any known primate and also don't match a human wearing padding or a suit. Creature performer and suit builder Janos Prochazka, known for his ape suit work on Star Trek and Lost in Space, also viewed the film. He said the creature looked real to him. Prochazka had spent his career building and wearing ape costumes on camera. If anyone could spot a suit, you'd think it would be him. And now for the skeptics. Smithsonian primate expert John Napier examined the film and offered a memorable assessment. He couldn't find obvious evidence of a costume, but he still didn't believe it showed a real animal. Other scientists dismissed it outright. They argued that 59 seconds of shaky footage from a man who had a financial motive to produce exactly this kind of film simply wasn't enough to overturn everything we know about North American wildlife. And the skeptics weren't just going on gut instinct. They had specific problems with the film. Patterson's background as a self-promoter, the convenient timing relative to his documentary project, and the fact that no one has ever produced a second piece of footage even remotely comparable, despite thousands of people looking for Bigfoot with increasingly sophisticated equipment in the decades since. But the strongest challenge to the film came from people who said they were directly involved in making it. In 2002, costume manufacturer Philip Morris came forward and said he'd sold Roger Patterson a gorilla suit in the summer of 1967. Morris said it was his standard six-piece suit, a head, a back-zippered fur torso with arms and legs, glove hands, and latex feet. According to Morris, Patterson asked for extra synthetic fur made of a material called Dynel, and advice on how to hide the eye holes. Morris says he told Patterson to apply black makeup around the wearer's eyes and to brush the fur down over the zipper line. On his own, this could be enough to call the whole thing into question. And then came the confession. In 2004, Patterson's friend, Bob Hieronymus, went public in Greg Long's book, The Making of Bigfoot. Hieronymus was one of the friends Patterson had recruited to act in his Bigfoot docudrama earlier in 1967. He knew Patterson's methods, his ambitions, and his debts. Hieronymus claimed he was the man in the suit. He said Patterson had recruited him through Bob Gimlin, promised him $1,000, and never paid. Hieronymus said he'd kept quiet for 36 years, partly because he hoped to eventually get some money, and partly because his lawyer told him he could face fraud charges if he confessed while Patterson was making money for the film. Several people in Yakima backed up Hieronymus' story. His family and friends said they'd seen a gorilla suit in the trunk of his mom's Buick in late 1967. So that's it, right? Case closed for real this time. Well, not just yet. Defenders of the Patterson-Gimlin film have pointed out several problems with the hoax narrative. Philip Morris's standard gorilla suit was designed for carnival sideshow girl-to-gorilla illusions, a classic carnival trick where a woman appears to transform into an ape right before the audience's eyes. The key thing is, these costumes were designed to be glimpsed briefly in dim lighting, not filmed for a minute in broad daylight. Hieronymus also described it as being made of horsehide, but Moore said it was Dynel. The physical proportions of the creature in the film don't match Hieronymus' body type, and no one has ever produced the actual suit. There was also a long-standing rumor that Academy Award-winning makeup artist John Chambers had secretly created the Bigfoot suit for Patterson. Chambers was the man behind the groundbreaking costumes in Planet of the Apes, which came out just 1 year after the PGF was filmed. So you can see why this rumor circulated in Hollywood for decades. Director John Landis even claimed that Chambers had confessed to him. But in a 1997 interview, Chambers himself flatly denied any involvement, saying, quote, "I'm good, but not that good," end quote. And then in March 2026, the story took its most dramatic turn yet. A documentary called Capturing Bigfoot, directed by Mark Evans, premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival. And it dropped a bombshell. A film technician named Norm Johnson, who'd worked for Boeing's film department in Seattle, had kept a canister of 16mm film locked in a safe for over 50 years. When Johnson died in 2024, his daughter gave the film to Evans. According to the documentary, Evans concluded it was rehearsal footage, a roughly 40-second clip, apparently shot before the 1967 expedition, showing a thinner figure in a Bigfoot costume walking through a wooded area similar to where the film was taken. And the biggest revelation came from Roger Patterson's own son. Clint Patterson, now in his mid-60s, appeared on camera and stated that his mother, Patricia, Roger's widow, had confirmed to him that Roger had faked the film to make money for the family. Bob Hieronymus, now in his 80s, also appeared in the documentary, reiterating his claim that he wore the suit. And in one remarkable scene captured by Evans' cameras, Hieronymus and Clint Patterson attended a 2024 Bigfoot convention and approached Bob Gimlin to tell him they were ready to come clean. Gimlin reportedly agreed to join them in revealing the hoax on camera, but that moment never came. The documentary has been widely covered, but it hasn't settled the debate, not even close. Believers have pushed back hard, questioning the chain of custody of the newly discovered film, whether the rehearsal footage is genuinely connected to the 1967 shoot, and whether Clint Patterson's account is reliable. Some point out that Mark Evans paid $30,000 in licensing fees to use Roger Patterson's original footage, money that went to the Patterson estate, creating a potential conflict of interest. But what about the two men behind it all? Bob Gimlin, now in his 90s, has never formally admitted to being part of any hoax. Roger Patterson himself maintained the film was genuine up to his death from Hodgkin's lymphoma in 1972 at age 38. So the film sits in this maddening limbo, never proven real and never quite proven fake beyond all doubt, even with a confession, supposed rehearsal footage, and a family admission. And that's precisely what makes it so fascinating. But the Patterson-Gimlin film is really just the tip of the iceberg, because underneath the debate over one piece of footage is a much bigger question. Does Bigfoot actually exist? Let's start with what mainstream science has to say. For most scientists, the answer is pretty straightforward. Bigfoot doesn't exist, and any sightings are either a hoax or a misidentification. So let's talk about the hoaxes first, because the Bigfoot field has been plagued by fraud from the very beginning. We already covered Ray Wallace's wooden feet at Bluff Creek. But that was just the start. Faked photographs, doctored audio recordings of supposed Bigfoot calls, and fabricated hair and fecal samples have been a constant problem over the years. Ray Wallace himself was known to plant hair from bison on his wild animal farm in the woods for researchers to find. And one of my favorite hoax stories is from 2008, when two men from Georgia held an international press conference claiming they'd found a Bigfoot body in the Appalachian Mountains. They had photos. They had a freezer full of evidence. They had media coverage from around the world. As for what was inside that freezer, it turned out to be a rubber Halloween costume stuffed with roadkill and animal entrails frozen in a block of ice. When the hoax was exposed, the press conference footage went viral, just not in the way they'd hoped. Then there's a misidentification angle, which is when people mistake a regular animal for something much more mysterious. The most common culprit, black bears. They're found throughout the Pacific Northwest, and they can and do walk on their hind legs, sometimes for surprising distances. A large black bear standing upright can reach 6 feet or more. Viewed from a distance through trees by someone who's primed to see Bigfoot, it's easy to understand how a bear could become something else in your mind. add in pareidolia, which is the tendency of the human brain to see humanoid shapes in ambiguous stimuli, and you've got a recipe for confident misidentifications. And the science backs this up. In 2014, geneticist Brian Sykes at Oxford University conducted one of the most rigorous Sasquatch studies ever attempted. His team collected 36 hair samples that had been submitted as Bigfoot or Yeti evidence from around the world. They used advanced DNA sequencing to identify what animal each hair actually came from. The results? Every single sample came from a known species. Bears, horses, cows, raccoons, deer, porcupines, and in two fascinating cases from the Himalayas, an ancient polar bear lineage. Intriguing for wildlife biology, not so much for Bigfoot hunters. Which brings us to the strongest scientific argument against Bigfoot, the breeding population problem. For a species of large primates to survive in North America over thousands of years, you need a viable breeding population. Hundreds or even thousands of individuals spread across a range large enough to sustain them. They would need food, territory, mates, and genetic diversity. And in all the decades of searching with trail cameras, drones, satellite imaging, eDNA sampling, and thousands of dedicated researchers combing the forests, no one has ever found a body. Not a skeleton, not a verified hair sample, not a single piece of DNA evidence that stands up to peer review. The scientific consensus is clear. There is no physical evidence for Bigfoot. But as we'll see, the believers have answers for all of this. As soon as the weather starts heating up, I immediately start pulling my lighter fabrics to the front of my closet. The pieces that look effortless but actually feel good the moment you pull them on, which for me is usually something linen. That is exactly why I keep coming back to Quince. They specialize in high-quality essentials like breathable linen, soft organic cotton, and even washable silk. But they do it all without that typical luxury markup. They have beautiful everyday pieces like 100% European linen pants, dresses, and tops with styles starting at just $32. Their denim is surprisingly soft, and I've been living in their linen button-down and paired with some gold jewelry. It's so lightweight, I actually forget I'm wearing it. And it isn't just clothes. They've become a total destination for home, kitchen, and bedding too. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/hidden for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/hidden for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/hidden.
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. T&Cs apply.
We all belong outside. We're drawn to nature, whether it's the recorded sounds of the ocean we doze off to or the succulents that adorn our homes. Nature makes all of our lives, well, better. Despite all this, we often go about our busy lives removed from it. But the outdoors is closer than we realize. With AllTrails, you can discover trails nearby and explore confidently. With offline maps and on-trail navigation, download the free app today and make the most of your summer with AllTrails.
Okay, so what if Bigfoot is a real animal? What would it be? The most scientifically grounded theory among Bigfoot believers is the Gigantopithecus hypothesis. And honestly, it's even more wild than you'd expect. In 1935, a German paleoanthropologist named G.H.R. von Koenigswald was browsing through a pharmacy in Hong Kong when something caught his eye. In the drawers where traditional Chinese medicines were kept, he found enormous primate molars for sale. In China, fossils had been sold as dragon bones for centuries, which were ground up and used as ingredients in traditional remedies. But von Koenigswald recognized these teeth as belonging to something even more extraordinary, a primate far larger than any living species. So he bought the teeth and started studying them. The molars were massive, roughly 20 by 22 millimeters, significantly larger than a gorilla's. Von Koenigswald named the new species Gigantopithecus. Over the following decades, researchers would collect hundreds more teeth and several jaw bones in China, Vietnam, and India, slowly piecing together the profile of the largest primate that ever lived. Based on these fossils and comparisons with gorillas and other modern apes, scientists estimate that Gigantopithecus stood up to 10 feet tall and may have weighed between 440 and over 1,000 pounds. Its teeth were riddled with cavities, suggesting a diet rich in fruits and fibrous vegetation, probably including bamboo. Gigantopithecus went extinct approximately 300,000 years ago, likely because climate change shrank its preferred subtropical forest habitat. But it coexisted with Homo erectus for hundreds of thousands of years. Early humans and giant apes lived side by side. So here's the question. Could that have been the birth of the Sasquatch legend? And is it possible that some of those giant apes survived? That is exactly what physical anthropologist Grover Krantz thought. Remember, he was one of the major supporters of the Patterson-Gimlin film, and he was definitely in the pro-Bigfoot camp. In the 1970s, Krantz argued that a population of Gigantopithecus could have survived extinction, migrated from Asia to North America over a land bridge during the Ice Age and adapted to the dense forests of the Pacific Northwest. Under this theory, Bigfoot sightings represent encounters with a relict population, a species we assumed went extinct hundreds of thousands of years ago, but didn't. It's a compelling idea, and the physical descriptions do line up in striking ways. Witnesses across decades have consistently described Bigfoot as standing 7 to 10 feet tall, weighing several hundred pounds, covered in dark hair, with a flat face, a pronounced brow ridge, long, powerful arms, and a stocky, muscular frame that moves with surprising speed. That profile matches what scientists think Gigantopithecus looked like, and the habitat argument is genuinely worth considering. The U.S. Forest Service manages nearly 25 million acres of national forest land in Oregon and Washington alone. Within that zone, there are 66 designated wilderness areas encompassing 4.6 million acres. Land where there's no motorized access and human presence is minimal. Add in British Columbia, whose forests cover close to 150 million acres, an area larger than any European country except Russia, and you're looking at an almost incomprehensible expanse of wild terrain. Some of these old growth forests are so dense that sunlight barely reaches the floor. Douglas firs grow up to 300 feet tall and 10 feet in diameter. There are valleys in the Pacific Northwest that have never been surveyed on foot. Could a large, intelligent primate remain hidden in that kind of landscape? Believers say yes. New species are still being discovered in remote forests around the world. The Sayola, a large ox-like animal weighing up to 220 pounds, wasn't discovered in the forests of Vietnam until 1992. But there are serious problems with this theory. First, all known Gigantopithecus fossils come from Asia. There is zero fossil evidence that any great ape ever lived in North America before humans arrived. Second, most researchers believe Gigantopithecus was almost certainly quadrupedal. It walked on all fours like a gorilla. Bigfoot is consistently described as bipedal, walking on 2 feet. Third, Gigantopithecus appears to have been a dietary specialist, eating mostly bamboo and other tough plants. It would have struggled to adapt to the varied ecosystems of North America. Even famed primatologist Jane Goodall publicly said she believed an undiscovered great ape could exist in North America, but she was careful to note that this was based on the volume of sightings, not unverified physical evidence. Still, the Gigantopithecus theory represents the least speculative version of the Bigfoot hypothesis. It's grounded in real paleontology, real evolutionary biology, and the very real fact that we continue to discover new species, including large ones, on a regular basis. So maybe the forests are hiding more than we think. And according to this next theory, it's hiding something we can't even comprehend. All right, let's go all the way out, because if you spend enough time in the Bigfoot community, you'll encounter theories that go far beyond undiscovered primates. Get ready for this. One of the more popular alternative theories is that Bigfoot is an interdimensional being, a creature that exists partially in our reality and partially in another plane. And yes, there's reasoning behind it. Supporters of this idea point to the fact that despite thousands of reported sightings, Bigfoot never leaves behind a body, verifiable DNA, or consistent physical evidence. It seems to appear and disappear at will. Some witnesses report that the creature simply vanished mid-sighting. One moment it was there, and the next it was gone. This actually aligns with some indigenous traditions. Many tribal nations describe Bigfoot-like beings as having supernatural abilities. The Nootka, Vancouver Island, believes Sasquatch could turn invisible or teleport. The Lummi told stories of it appearing as a deer or bear to trick hunters, then revealing its true form. Plateau tribes describe so-called stick Indians, who could confuse people by whistling and cause them to get lost in familiar forests. So there's definitely a history of Bigfoot-like creatures operating in ways beyond our understanding. Then there's a UFO connection. Yes, seriously. A surprisingly large number of Bigfoot reports are accompanied by reports of unusual lights in the sky, electromagnetic disturbances, or other anomalous phenomena. Some researchers have grouped Bigfoot with other high strangeness events, suggesting the creature may be associated with whatever phenomenon is behind UFO sightings. Now, is there scientific evidence for any of this? No. But these theories are worth mentioning because they reveal something important about why the Bigfoot legend endures. It's not just about whether a big ape is hiding in the woods. For many people, Bigfoot represents something deeper. A connection to the wild, to the unknown, to the idea that the world still holds genuine mysteries. Nature writer Robert Michael Pyle studied Bigfoot enthusiasts for his book, Where Bigfoot Walks, and concluded that many of them don't actually want to find Bigfoot. They want to be Bigfoot. The creature represents freedom from civilization, from rules, from the modern world. Maybe the most interesting thing about Bigfoot isn't whether it's real. It's what our answer to that question reveals about us. You know what strikes me most about the Patterson-Gimlin film and Bigfoot discourse? It's not the creature. It's the reaction to it. For almost 60 years, people have looked at the same 59 seconds of footage and come away with completely opposite conclusions. Same film, same frames, same shaky camera work. And yet, where one person sees definitive proof of a new species, another person sees a guy in a gorilla suit. That tells us something profound about how belief works. We don't just see evidence, we interpret it. And our interpretation is shaped by everything we already believe, everything we want to be true, and everything we're afraid of. The scientific establishment sees a grainy film with no corroborating physical evidence and says, not enough. Fair. But the believer sees a creature whose movement, proportions, and behavior don't match any known animal or any costume ever produced and says, what more do you need? And then there's the indigenous perspective, which asks a different question entirely. Why do you need to prove something that's been known for thousands of years? I think the Patterson-Gimlin film endures because it sits right on that line between the explainable and the inexplicable. It's close enough to a hoax to be dismissed and close enough to real to be haunting, and we can't look away. Okay, so where do I actually land on this? I'll be honest, after looking at all the evidence, I think the Patterson-Gimlin film is probably a hoax. And the Capturing Bigfoot documentary makes that conclusion harder than ever to avoid. You now have rehearsal footage, a confession from Patterson's own son relaying his mother's admission, the continued claims of Bob Hieronymus, and the historical record of Patterson's questionable financial dealings. And there was Patterson's Hodgkin's lymphoma diagnosis, a dying man desperate to leave something behind for his family. That doesn't make him a villain, although it does make the financial motive impossible to ignore. But even the documentary's defenders acknowledge it isn't quite a slam dunk. Some Bigfoot researchers have questioned the chain of custody of the newly discovered film and whether the footage truly shows what Mark Evans claims it shows. And so the debate continues. Here's what I keep coming back to. The best costume and special effects experts of the 1960s looked at this film and couldn't figure out how it was done. John Chambers, the man behind Planet of the Apes, said it was beyond his abilities. He wasn't just being humble. Other Hollywood professionals, including Universal Studios technicians and a Disney executive, reached similar conclusions. Modern biomechanics analyses have failed to replicate the creature's gait using human subjects. If it's a suit, it's the single greatest costume ever created, made by a broke rodeo cowboy with no special effects training using technology from 1967. That's not impossible, but it does give me pause. As for Bigfoot itself, I'm a scientist. I follow the evidence. And the evidence says there's no verified physical proof of a large undiscovered primate in North America. But I'm also someone who respects the traditions of the indigenous peoples who have known about this being for millennia. Just because Western science hasn't confirmed something doesn't mean it isn't real. We've been wrong before. The ocean was supposed to be fully mapped. Then we found hydrothermal vents teeming with life. The coelacanth was supposed to be extinct for 66 million years. Then a fisherman caught one in 1938. Science is a process of discovering how much we don't know. So do I think Bigfoot is out there? Probably not. But do I think the forests of North America still hold secrets? Absolutely. And I think anyone who says otherwise isn't paying attention. So if the Patterson-Gimlin film were shot today, how would it all go down? First of all, it wouldn't be 59 seconds of shaky 16mm film. It would be a 4K video from a smartphone. Roger Patterson wouldn't need to rent a camera and ship the film to be developed. He'd be live streaming the encounter to the entire internet before the creature even finished walking across the creek bed. And that's both a blessing and a curse. On one hand, the footage would be crystal clear. We could see every hair, every muscle movement, every detail of the face. AI analysis could assess the creature's proportions in real time. There'd be GPS coordinates, timestamps, and metadata embedded in the file. Or at least that's what you'd think. But modern Bigfoot sightings haven't played out like that. Take one from October 2024, when a TikToker named Emmanuel Alfaro posted a 10-second clip showing what appeared to be a large, hair-covered figure leaning against a tree in Oklahoma's parallel forest. The video went viral almost instantly, racking up millions of views. It was remarkably clear compared to most Bigfoot footage. You could actually see the creature's features, appearing to sniff at leaves before looking around. And the reaction? Immediately split. Some people were genuinely shaken. Others called it an obvious fake. Look up the Jack Link's adult Sasquatch costume if you're curious. No one could agree, and there was no way to verify anything after the fact. That's how it played out with a lot of modern Bigfoot videos. We live in the age of deepfakes, CGI, and the AI-generated content so convincing that experts can't always tell the difference. The very technology that should give us better evidence has also given us infinite reasons to doubt any evidence. Ironically, the Patterson-Gimlin film may be more compelling because of its limitations. The grain, the shake, the disturbance. In a world where anything can be faked, the imperfect evidence of 1967 carries a strange kind of authenticity. But here's what would really be different today. The indigenous perspective would finally be part of the conversation. In 1967, nobody asked the Hupa or the Yurok what they thought about the creature filmed on their ancestral land. Today, those voices would be centered, and they might offer a framework for understanding Bigfoot that science alone never could. Whether you think it's a primate, a spirit, or a guy in a suit, Bigfoot isn't going anywhere. And honestly, in a world that feels increasingly mapped, measured, and monitored, maybe that's exactly what we need. The possibility that something out there is still beyond our understanding. So stay curious and maybe keep your camera ready. Thanks so much for joining me for this episode of Hidden History. I'm Dr. Harini Bhatt. Join me next time as we explore another unbelievable story from the past. What do you think of the Patterson-Gimlin film? Brilliant hoax or genuine encounter? And do you believe in Bigfoot? Let me know in the comments and I might talk about it in a future episode. And be sure to subscribe on YouTube or rate, review, and follow if you're listening on audio so we can keep building this community together. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you next episode.
Are you really buying a car online on AutoTrader right now?
Really?
At a playground?
Yeah, really. Look at these listings from dealers.
Wow, your search can really get that specific.
Really?
And you just put in your info and boom, car's in your budget.
Mom needs a second, honey.
You can really have it delivered?
Really? Or I can pick it up at the dealership.
Mom!
One sec, sweetie.
Mommy's buying a car.
Mommy, look!
I think your kid is walking up the slide.
Kyle, again? Really?
AutoTrader. Buy your car online. Really?